Over the course of my career as a neuroscientist, I've seen thousands of people who share similar backgrounds respond in dramatically different ways to the same life event. Some are resilient in the face of stress, for instance, while others fall apart. The latter become anxious, depressed, or unable to function when they encounter adversity. Resilient people are somehow able not only to withstand, but to benefit from certain kinds of stressful events and to turn adversity into advantage. This, in a nutshell, is the puzzle that has driven my research. I've wanted to know what determines how someone reacts to divorce, to the death of a loved one, to the loss of a job, or to any other setback, and equally, what determines how people react to a career triumph, to winning the heart of their true love, to realizing that a friend will walk over hot coals for them, or to other sources of happiness. Why and how do people respond so widely in their emotional responses to the ups and downs of life?
That's Richard Davidson reading from his acclaimed new book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain, How Its Unique Patterns Affect the Way You Think, Feel, and Live, and How You Can Change Them. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
We think of the brain as the organ of reason and thought. But increasing scientific evidence points to the brain as key in understanding our unique emotional style, our ability to feel happiness, to recover from trauma, or to be sensitive to others. Can we change our emotional style? Or are some of us just doomed to be more depressed than others? How do scientific studies of emotion shed light on the effectiveness of therapies such as mindfulness and meditation? Joining us to discuss the emotional life of the brain and his unconventional career studying the emotions of subjects ranging from infants to the Dalai Lama is Richard Davidson, professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here again.
Well, let's start with your approach, which in its origins was considered pretty unorthodox. You encountered a lot of skepticism in this idea of combining studies of meditation and then hardwiring of the brain.
The early part of my career, I would say, certainly encountered some rough going. There were several, I think, formidable obstacles. One is the idea that some of the parts of the brain that scientists at that point in time, we're now talking about the mid or late 1970s, considered to be the pinnacle of human reason, such as the prefrontal cortex, which is a part of the brain that has evolved most recently over the course of evolution. And that part of the brain, particularly at that time, was considered to be critically involved in the highest human thought. And I was beginning to investigate its possible role in emotion.
Why would you pick the least likely part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex?
Well, I had the great fortune of being influenced by some extraordinary minds at the time. And when I was a graduate student, I was a graduate student at Harvard, but I took neuroanatomy at MIT from what was then one of the world's great living neuroanatomists, a scientist by the name of Wally Nauta. And he studied the frontal lobes. And actually, based upon the anatomy of the frontal lobes and the connections of the frontal lobes, which was his area of expertise, it seemed very clear that the frontal lobes played a very important role in integrating thought and emotion. And the idea that it was exclusively involved with thought was inconsistent with the accruing anatomical evidence. And so although it had not yet been investigated in intact human beings, it just seemed to me that based upon what we were beginning to understand about the anatomy, it really made sense.
And we seem to be learning more and more about the total integration of the brain. There are not necessarily isolated parts of it, but they all interact, obviously.
They do. The classical philosophical split between thought and feeling is not a distinction that is respected by the brain.
I was interested in your book that you go all the way back to, I think maybe you were 15 or something, and you were working in a sleep lab and looking at dreams. How would you sort of point to that as part of your early interest in our brains and the kind of fantastical things that go on inside them?
Well, you know, for whatever reason, I was drawn to this work as a kid. And I used to read Science News, which was a weekly periodical in the library when I was in high school. And I read a little blurb about research that was being done at a hospital not far from where I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, I thought I can call and see if they needed a volunteer. So I was really drawn to it. And one of the things that I was particularly drawn to is that in the study of dreams, one of the major advances in the study of dreams was the finding that there are reliable biological indicators that denoted periods of time when a person was sleeping during which they were dreaming.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With the electrodes and the...
Exactly. Yeah. The eye movements REM. And changes, yeah. REM sleep, which stands for rapid eye movements, and changes in the brain electroencephalogram, which is the electrical recording of brain activity. And to me, that was just as a 15-year-old kid, just fantastically cool, that we can actually use an external objective indicator, and that indicator provides us with reliable information about what is going on in the mental life of a person.
Well, I suppose it's a good example of what can almost seem oxymoronic, this idea of studying dreams, you know, of measuring scientifically something that seems so irrational.
That's right. And that gave me, I think, some early hope and began to articulate a path for the a serious scientific investigation of some of the more elusive qualities of mind.
You were doing your early research, if we're talking about the 70s, on brains that were not necessarily completely intact. In other words, you didn't have the means or had very limited means to actually work with intact brains. You could work more with a brain that had part of it removed or impaired or something and learn from that.
Right. That's certainly true. Some of the early insights that we gleaned about the brain and emotion came from the study of patients with selective damage to their brain, observing the behavioral consequences of that selective damage. The methods that we had available to interrogate the intact human brain were, as you say, quite limited. They involved, at that time, putting sensors or electrodes on the scalp surface, similar to what was done and what is done with sleep recording, to try to make inferences about what's going on in the brain. But that's kind of been likened to placing a stethoscope on the hood of a car and trying to figure out how a car works by listening to the sounds that you hear.
But you had premises back then based on that limited ability to study it, and now we can work much more with intact brains, and that has borne out most of your, if not all of your early premises?
Well, you know, I certainly it's borne out the broad outlines. A lot of the details have gotten revised as we have obtained more precise information, but it's difficult to overestimate the importance of the new developments in technology that have allowed us to non-invasively peer into the structure and function of the living human brain.
I was also struck by your account of early experiments that you did with infants with water, sugar water, and lemons. Can you talk about that and why it was so useful to have babies as opposed to adults with all their different circumstances and complexities?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that question. And early on, one of the key questions as this research program developed was the extent to which propensities for emotion and individual differences among people were present from the start at birth. And in order to answer that question, we really needed to study newborn infants. And there are a limited range of things that you can do with a newborn infant to provoke emotion. And I actually was particularly struck by observations that were actually made by Charles Darwin that were reported in his book, that was written in 1872, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, which really was an extraordinary book where Darwin took on the whole topic of emotion. He was interested in the expressive signs of emotion, and he talked about facial expressions in infants. And one of the ways that you can provoke an emotion and elicit a facial expression in an infant quite reliably is to put tastes in their mouth. That is one sensory system that appears to be pretty well developed at birth. And so we took advantage of that and we placed a little bit of lemon juice in one condition and a little bit of sugar water in another condition right on their tongue and videotaped them and at the same time recorded their brain electrical activity. And we indeed were able to provoke reliably different facial signs of emotion within the first 72 hours after birth. And there were accompanying changes in the brain electrical signature that we measured while the infants were expressing these different emotions.
Just wait till they grow up and come back, Richard.
Right.
You have some answering to do. But when you're testing these various infants, did you then go back and see how, for example, resilient they were, having had some lemon juice instead of the milk they might have been expecting?
We've done that with older samples, not with the infant samples, but that's a wonderful question. And that's a question, of course, that has since motivated a lot of work that we've done that I talk about in the book. But a few years after we undertook that study with infants, we began a study with three-year-olds where we looked at similar qualities in three-year-olds using more age-appropriate methods to elicit emotion. And there the focus was on variations among these individuals in how they responded to the same emotional challenge. And one of the things that we did in the three-year-olds is they were in a playroom with age-appropriate toys on their floor. On the floor, the mom was sitting in a chair in a corner just filling out some questionnaires, and the mom was told not to interact with the child, and the child was just playing with the toys. And then at a certain point in time, a robot walks into the room that's remote controlled and says, "Hi, I'm Roby the robot. I've come to play with you." And we observe how the toddler responds to that robot. And one of the wonderful things is if you test 300 or more of children of this age, and in our initial study of this kind, we tested about 350 kids, you see just huge variation, just enormous. Some kids run right over to the robot, shake it, you know, want to play with it right away, and other kids have what looks close to like a panic attack.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But how do you then tell what's nurture and what's nature? Because built in by three would be how parents respond to scary things or different things. Also, is that child in an abusive home? Is the child, you know, how is the child being treated at home could also influence that.
Yeah, right? It's a wonderful question. And the fact is that even in a newborn infant 72 hours after birth, or even if you got them 1 minute after birth, what you see is a product of both nature and nurture, and they're inextricably interwoven. And there's no question that there are some genetic propensities to these dispositions. There's also no question that early environment plays an important role, even the intrauterine environment. And so the level that a mom the level of stress that a mom is exposed to during her pregnancy will affect the biology of the infant. It will actually affect how the brain is wired up. And there's good research to indicate that. And so the environment is really quite pervasive. And one of the thrusts of my book is the idea that the brain is constantly being shaped, wittingly or unwittingly.
That's the nurture. I mean,
that's
really
the nurture part, right? And that because it's constantly being shaped, we can actually, as adults also as adults with our children, take more responsibility for the more optimal or positive shaping of the brain.
You call it plastic, that the brain is more plastic than we've thought, that it's possible to change your emotions.
That's right. The brain exhibits a quality that scientists call plasticity or neuroplasticity, which simply means that the brain can change in response to experience. And I think it's fair to say that more than any other organ in the body, it's really built to change in response to experience. That's its principal job, if you will.
Adaptation.
But back to these three-year-olds with the robot, I'm wondering, do you have in mind a certain ideal response? Because you could argue that the toddler that goes right up to the robot and tries to take it apart, that although that might look like boldness and I don't know, self-confidence and all that, it also could suggest a lack of caution. You know, that the child that holds back, that might be a useful instinct at times. And so, you know, I mean, throughout the book, I've kind of wondered, do you have a set of ideals? The sort of, when we always think it's better to be happy, obviously, than sad, but some of these other things seem a little bit more murky.
Wonderful question. And, you know, it was difficult, but I tried as hard as I could in the book to really be clear about this issue, and that is that there is no ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there is an ideal. Certainly, once a person crosses into frank pathology, I think everyone would agree that it's not adaptive. But within a broad range, I think that there is not an ideal. It really depends upon a person in relation to her or his particular environmental niche. And different emotional styles are appropriate for different environmental circumstances. If we all had the same emotional style, I think it would be deleterious to our culture and also probably pretty boring.
We'd all be.
And also, a lot of us would be unemployed because we'd all have the same aptitudes.
Exactly.
We'd all be bungee jumping or doing something
right.
High risk. What other key studies, before you got to the part you talk about in the emotional brain where you're looking at the six areas and so on, what other key studies after the study of the three-year-olds would you say were important in formulating your ideas?
Well, there were quite a few studies. The work that we've done on autism was critically important in formulating the notion of the social intuition style. The social intuition style is one of the six emotional styles that I describe in the book. And it refers to the continuum of skill at decoding or perceiving nonverbal cues of emotion. They may be facial expressions, tone of voice, body posture. Those are all cues that we use to infer another person's emotional state. And it turns out that there are at least a large subgroup of individuals on the autism spectrum who have a difficult time with that. And so the research in autism really helped me to better understand the role of individual differences on that dimension. And even within the autism spectrum, there are variations. So not all children with autism show impairments in that ability. And it's also the case that a person can be so acutely focused on those nonverbal
become
cues.
Become kind of dysfunctional that way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that gets back to your point, Emily, that there is no formula for an ideal emotional style. And every one of us has each of these six dimensions, and we all vary along these six dimensions. And what's best for one person is not necessarily best for another.
There are degrees of all of these things. I mean, in other words, you can be overstated. You can be sort of socially clueless in terms of picking up on those cues without being autistic or even slightly autistic.
Absolutely. And for example, there are probably individuals who, you know, at the risk of really depicting a caricature, but individuals who work in the high-tech industry, who interact mostly with machines
uh-huh.
during the day and don't interact with humans, who may not be so highly skilled at decoding social cues, but it's not necessary for them. And in fact, they may if they paid more attention to social cues, it may interfere with their ability to focus on what they're really good at and what they enjoy doing. And so, again, it underscores the importance of diversity for the optimal success of the society as a whole.
I've kind of suspected that of some of the animal handlers I've known, too, people who are much better with horses than they are with people.
And certainly the insights of Temple Grandin, the famous author who also is on the autism spectrum and has written a lot about that. She's made seminal contributions to work in animal
handling
care.
Of cattle, for example, yes. Processing.
Yeah. Male-female differences in the response at three to the robot?
Well, you know, over the course of my career, I have looked for gender differences in various kinds of studies where we've had large enough samples to look at it. And, you know, in some studies we find them. But I must say that sort of stepping back and looking at 30-plus years of research and also as a student of diversity and emotional style, overwhelmingly what strikes me is not the gender differences, but that is differences among people in general far outweigh, to me, differences between males and females.
We've been talking about six types of emotional styles, and we're going to get into what those six types are when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Richard Davidson, and we're talking about his new book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain. Before you tell us these six types that you identify, can you tell us what you mean by emotional style?
Sure. What I mean by emotional style is a consistent way of responding to emotionally challenging or provocative events in our environment. And people differ in how they respond to emotional challenges, to both positive events, successes, as well as how they respond to stresses. And the variations among people in those responses in aggregate constitute what I mean by emotional style.
And how did you come up with your six types and tell us what they are?
Well, you know, I came up with the six types over the course of 30 years, really. I didn't sit down one day and decide, okay, how many emotional styles are there and deductively derive these six. They really, it was much more of an inductive process.
They emerged.
That emerged, right, over the course of a long career of research. So each one of these six is based upon a body of neuroscientific evidence. And the six are resilience is the first one. Resilience refers to how fast or slowly you respond to adversity. How fast or slowly you recover, I should say, from adversity. Some people, in response to a stressful event, are able to come back to baseline quickly. They recover very quickly. Other people ruminate and perseverate and show a much more persistent response. That's resilience. Another style we call outlook. Outlook, in some sense, refers to whether you see the world with rosy-colored glasses or more gloomy glasses, whether you see a glass as half empty or half full. And it refers to the duration of positive emotion that a person experiences. How persistent is positive emotion? A third style I call social intuition, which I mentioned earlier, and that refers to a person's skill at detecting nonverbal cues of emotion like facial expression or tone of voice. A fourth style is self-awareness. Self-awareness refers to how accurate a person is in decoding the bodily cues in him or herself that are associated with emotion. Bodily cues include things like changes in your heart rate or blood pressure, changes in your breathing patterns, or changes in your muscle tension, all of which are important cues for a person, him or herself, for your own emotions. A Fifth style is sensitivity to context. And what I mean here is how a person alters their emotional response as a function of the context in which they reside. So, for example, having a conversation with your spouse is very different than having a conversation with your boss.
I don't know.
And so the origin of this particular style actually came from work with – mostly with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it turns out that the kind of bodily changes that arise in response to a traumatic event actually serve a really adaptive role when the trauma occurs. But for example, if someone who is exposed to a traumatic event where there are a lot of loud noises, imagine a war scene with sirens and so forth, imagine that they're now back in their neighborhood in a safe place in the United States, and an ambulance goes down the street with the siren. Well, a person suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder sometimes fails to make the distinction between a safe context, which is just walking on the sidewalk with an ambulance passing, and the traumatic context, and that can elicit all kinds of deleterious changes in the mind and the body.
I think you even talk about somebody who had a fatal car crash because of that.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the context dimension. And the last dimension is attention. And normally attention is not thought of as a dimension of emotional style, but there's such a large corpus of research that speaks to the important interaction between attention and emotion. And the attention dimension is a dimension that goes from being very focused to being very scattered. And this is something that plays a key role in modulating our emotional response to situations.
If we go back to resilience, we, I presume, would have different kinds of resilience for different people. For example, if my office is moved away from, you know, a nice view, then I would have trouble coping with that for months to come. Whereas if I get stuck paying the lunch bill, it doesn't bother me. But it could be the other way around for another person.
Sure, sure. So there are different triggers which may be particularly problematic for some people. But the notion of emotional styles is the idea that these are dimensions which likely express themselves in a variety of contexts, so that if you had a problem when your office was moved, you will also likely have a problem recovering from other kinds of challenges. And it may be that they need to be of a certain magnitude. So certainly having your office move would be a more serious challenge, presumably, than losing a quarter in a vending machine. But given the same magnitude or intensity of challenge, the likelihood is that you would respond in a similar way.
For some reason, whenever I read something where it says there's six things, I start thinking of a seventh. But probably a different category would be incorporated in one of your areas. But let me just ask you about this. It seems to me that people have different degrees of understanding humor and using humor in their life as a sort of coping mechanism. And maybe this is part of resilience, maybe it's part of outlook. But if I think of my father, who's a Holocaust survivor, his ability to joke, his ability to find the funny part of life seems to me a key part of resilience.
Yeah, I think it is a very key part of resilience. I would also consider it a key part of what I call the outlook style, mm-hmm. that is being able to maintain positive emotion. And I think it is one of the ways, a very important way, in which those two emotional styles in particular are modulated.
How does outlook relate to being realistic, though? I mean, sometimes they really are out to get you, you know. I mean, sometimes the situation really is hopeless, but you have to cope somehow.
Yeah. And you know, in the book, I talk about situations where too positive an outlook can really get you into trouble. And so, again, this goes back to Emily's comment earlier, which I think is really important, which is that there is no ideal place. And I think that the sometimes I think in our culture, we tend to think that, you know, the person who is the most resilient in the sense that I'm using it and has the most positive outlook has the most optimal emotional style. And that's just not true. I think that there are many cases that we can think of where that would be really maladaptive.
Well, let's talk about resilience if you lose a loved one. couldn't – like, let's say you're trying – I'm trying to picture how you would measure this sort of scientifically. But if you look at someone who has lost a spouse and you try to figure out how quickly do they seem to get over it, for one thing, there would be such differences in terms of the degree of love within a relationship. In other words, some marriages are more to grieve over than others.
Absolutely.
And even in looking at how someone gets over it, so to speak, some people mask emotion more than others. How do you take something like that that seems so fuzzy and make it a rational, scientific situation?
Well, wonderful question. And it'd be really fun to have you in the lab, Emily, and to you're a great student. The way we do it essentially is this. Your intuitions, I think, are extremely right on that if you use a naturalistic event like the death of a spouse, there's so much variation in the nature of the relationship and the length of the relationship and all kinds of factors which play into that. And so we typically don't use those kinds of stimuli, if you will, in the laboratory. What we use are more standardized stimuli. So we'll actually present a painful stimulus to a person, you know, we give everyone the exact same stimulus. And
we're not talking torture, though.
We're not talking torture, but we're talking. I mean, this is something where we can actually probe in a very objective way the rapidity of recovery. So, one of the things that we do is we can use thermal pain, which is a very realistic burning sensation, but we can do it in a way which is perfectly safe. And we can actually track in the brain how long it takes you to recover from that kind of pain. And it turns out that there are wide variations across people in how long it takes them to recover, and that those differences predict important features of the resilience dimension in real life. And so we can use those kinds of objective measures in the laboratory in conjunction with assessing what is going on in real life. And the way we find out what's going on in real life, one of the things we're doing now is, since a vast majority of the population has smartphones, we actually are doing studies now where we send text messages to people during their day, very simple text messages, and we just ask them, you know, something about what's happening right now and how they feel right now. And we can track over time their emotions over the course of the day using that kind of strategy. And scientists have found that when you ask a person in the moment, right now, how are you feeling, rather than retrospectively integrating over time, people's reports are actually more valid. That is, they tend to relate to other dimensions of their life, and they better relate to what we find in the laboratory as well.
But how do you show a direct link between the ability to handle physical pain and emotional pain?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, there's no such thing as just physical pain. It always elicits emotional pain. But we also use more socially relevant stimuli in the laboratory as well. So it's not just a non-social physical stimulus, but we use all kinds of social stimuli that range from images of people who are in difficult situations, who are suffering, or sounds that depict human suffering, or actually engaging in a social interaction where you're treated unfairly, for example. All of those are methods that we can bring into the laboratory. And it's only through a combination of these many different indices do we then develop confidence that what we're measuring is something that is actually robust and consistent.
And let's say people who get angry quickly, like the kind who suffer from road rage or who seem to just constantly have a short fuse, what do you actually see then in their brain that's different? Somebody who gets angry all the time, what do certain parts light up?
That's a good question, and there's a little bit of research that speaks to that issue, and there's some evidence to suggest that there are differences in the timing of activation in certain brain regions, and a person who has a really short fuse is someone whose circuitry in particular brain regions activates more quickly. And we can see that using modern brain imaging methods.
And does anger fit into outlook, or where does that fit in?
Yeah. Anger, you know, would fit into both outlook as well as resilience. Again, and a person who has a really positive outlook style is someone who I think is less likely to have a short fuse, and also someone who's resilient, who recovers quickly from adversity. If they get angry, they're very likely to recover quickly and will not. There are people who would unlikely hold a grudge. So, you know, I think where anger can really get us into trouble is when it persists. If we express anger in the moment and then come back to baseline quickly, it often is less problematic.
So, for example, let's see, would the urge for revenge be a component of anger, persistent anger?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's turn to self-awareness. Know thyself. What is it that, you know, when you're looking at people on a scale of very self-aware or very unaware, what do you see? And is it true that that ignorance is bliss?
Well, you know, some people really have a hard time putting their own emotions into words. And it turns out that those people also have a hard time feeling what's going on in their bodies. And there are – emotion is very much an embodied process. That is, it's something that clearly occurs in the brain, but it also clearly occurs in the body. It's both. And people who are self-aware – are in touch with what's going on in their body. They can actually accurately monitor the signals.
And they know what's causing it?
Not necessarily, but often. So you can be aware of what's going on in your body and still not know what is causing it. So that's another component of awareness, which is really not exclusively self-awareness, but that's really more being aware of your environment. And that would actually be part of context because it has to do more with whatever is triggering the emotion in the environment, or social intuition, maybe another person's emotional reaction to you, which is producing a change in yourself. Those are all factors which need to be considered. But people, you can measure the extent to which people can accurately perceive what's going on in their body. And again, to underscore a theme that we've been talking about, it's not necessarily always the best thing to be acutely aware of everything that's going on in your body.
I would think you could make your own blood pressure keep going higher and higher, you know.
Exactly. And people who are really at the extreme of this are people who are prone to panic disorder, who with the slightest change in...
Oh, I think my pulse is up. Oh, my gosh, it is up.
Right. And they have, you know, they can think they're having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is a dimension along which people vary, and what's optimal for one person may not be optimal for another.
So what's going on in the prefrontal cortex anyway? If it's the seat of reason and emotion... How is it connecting these two? Because, I mean, there is still this sense that that's a contradictory role.
Well, when you reflect on the most complicated decisions in life, such as a decision to – should I be a life partner with this person, or should I buy this house? Big decisions that we make in our life. We don't make that many of them. But we certainly each make some of them. When you reflect on those decisions, those are not decisions which are made on the basis of a cold cognitive calculus.
Not purely rational.
Right. Mm-hmm. Those are all decisions which are benefited by and informed by our emotion. We could not make those decisions were it not for the integration of feeling and thought, which takes place in the prefrontal cortex.
And you might not be aware of the emotional coloring of this decision. In other words, you might not be aware that, oh, this house has a yellow room that reminds me of my childhood home or something like that.
Exactly, exactly. But those influences are constantly churning.
Where does empathy fit in? I mean, is that part of – the sensitivity to context, or is that part of a kind of awareness?
Well, it's mostly social intuition, part of the social intuition style. And the first and probably the most important element of empathy actually, there are two elements. One is social intuition and the other is self-awareness. Those two together really are the most important constituents of empathy. The first ingredient requires that you be able to decode another person's nonverbal cues of emotion. In order to be empathic with another person, you have to be able to actually perceive the cues which lead you to be empathic. The second is you need to be able to actually experience those things in your own body. And one of the things that occurs in empathy that modern research has taught us is that we actually simulate the facial expressions, the body postures of another when we have an empathic response to them.
Sometimes to a fault, I suspect. I occasionally have noticed my mother picking up the accent of the person she was talking to, and it could be a little bit come across a little bit like mockery, I suppose, or I suppose an unintended compliment.
Right. Well, that's a great example. But I think that, you know, those are very important elements of empathy.
We're going to talk about other aspects of emotional styles and what you can do about it. What can you do to change your emotions when we continue in a moment with University of the Air?
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Richard Davidson, the author most recently of The Emotional Life of Your Brain, How Its Unique Patterns Affect the Way You Think, Feel, and Live, and How You Can Change Them. And he's identified six emotional styles based on some 30 years of research. Let's say we want to change one of them. You know, it was self-improvement here. How would we go about it?
Well, each of these six emotional styles, as I describe in the book, are based upon an understanding of the brain mechanisms that are associated with them, that support them. And as we talked earlier, one of the great insights of modern neuroscience is the insight of plasticity or neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain can change in response to experience or to training. The fact is that every one of the brain circuits important for each of these six emotional styles is constantly being shaped and affected by our environment, wittingly or unwittingly, mostly unwittingly. That is, most of us are just being bombarded and go about our daily life without paying much explicit attention to the fact that our emotional styles are being shaped in this way. And what I suggest in the book is that we can actually be more intentional about this. We can be more explicit. And in the book, I actually provide some simple questionnaires for people to take that would provide some information on where they fall along each of the six dimensions of emotional style that I describe. The first ingredient for change, if a person wishes to change, if they feel that where they fall in a particular emotional style is not well suited for them and they want to change, the first ingredient is awareness. That is, being aware of where they fall. Some people are more aware of that than others, and these questionnaires can hopefully be helpful in providing information to a person about where she or he may fall.
If he answers it honestly.
If he answers it honestly, of course, which is one of the limitations of these kinds of self-report measures, which I talk about in the book, and that's why these six emotional styles are not based on self-report measures. They're based upon objective measurements of the brain, but I couldn't figure out a way to get all the readers to come into our lab to undergo brain scans. This was the next best thing. So in order to change our emotional styles, you know, it depends upon which emotional style it is we wish to change. And I've been very influenced by my relationship with the Dalai Lama and the contact that I've had with the kind of traditions that he represents, because there is a whole technology of mental exercise that comes from those traditions that can be rendered in a completely secular way, which I think has some utility in helping us to change different dimensions of emotional style.
Are you talking about meditation in particular?
Yeah, types of meditation. So let me maybe give one example. The Outlook style is a style that I describe that is associated with the extent to which a person shows a persistence of positive emotion. And some people, when something good happens, they may have a fleeting sort of blip in their level of well-being, but it doesn't last. It's very fleeting. And so there are some very specific kinds of meditation practices that involve the explicit cultivation of certain kinds of positive emotions. And one of the things that the Dalai Lama has said, and there's now experimental evidence from the scientific literature, I think, that's consistent with this, is that one of the best ways of promoting enduring well-being is to be kind to others. Very simple in terms of the recommendation, but how to put it into practice. So there are types of meditation that involve what is called loving kindness, that is wishing that another person be well, wishing them happiness. And it can be done for just a few minutes a day. It often involves repeating some simple phrases to yourself in your mind, phrases like, we bring a person to mind first, visualize them, and then we can repeat some simple phrases such as, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live your life with ease. And we just do that repetitively over time with different categories of people.
Sounds like prayer.
Well, I was going to say, it just sounds like a benediction, doesn't it? I mean, it is a benediction.
It is, of sorts, absolutely. It's one that is rendered in a completely secular way. And I think one of the key elements here is the regularity of practice. One of the things that modern neuroscience teaches us is that in order to actually form new connections in the brain, in order to change the brain, systematic practice is very important. And it's kind of like physical exercise. We all know that if we engage in systematic physical exercise, our bodies can change. But if we engage in a 2-week or 3-week program of physical exercise and then stop, no one is going to think that those effects are going to persist. Same is true for this kind of mental exercise.
And if you're thinking about others, I suppose it's a way to get out of your own head, just get out of focusing on what's wrong in your own life.
I think that's precisely true. And a lot of the inability to persist in showing positive emotion and also the persistence of negative emotion following adversity is due to a lot of self-related rumination. And so being able to, as you put it, Emily, to get out of your head and focus on others is something that I think can be very helpful.
How important is it for that other person to be aware of your feeling, your beneficent feeling toward them?
I don't think it's important at all. Although I do think that when you encounter that other person, you are likely to behave somewhat differently.
And then you feel better about yourself if you've given to someone or if you've been kind. In this country, depression is big business. In other words, lots of money is being made on antidepressants, on talk therapy. After your 30 years of research, what do you see in the sort of practice of psychotherapy and psychiatry in general that troubles you and that encourages you?
Well, first, let me just begin this by saying that I'm not someone who is anti-medication. I believe that for a person who is really seriously ill, the judicious use of certain kinds of psychiatric medication may well be appropriate. I believe that there's a lot of change that we can actually produce in a safer way with fewer side effects and also produce change that's more enduring and that's not dependent on an external agent, and also, particularly in this economic climate, is a whole lot cheaper. So that's one thing. The second thing is I think that traditional models of psychotherapy where a person goes to a therapist once a week and has a 45-minute or one-hour session is lunacy when it comes to understanding the brain. I mean, the idea that you can just spend 45 minutes a week working on something and then not do it for the rest of the week and then and produce meaningful change is so inconsistent with everything we know about the brain. On the other hand, in fairness to my psychology colleagues, modern psychological treatments which have received good scientific support like cognitive therapy in fact involve a lot of home practice. And so there is specific exercises that are actually given to people to do on a daily basis. And so I think that that kind of strategy is one that takes advantage of the insights that we've gleaned from this kind of neuroscientific
approach.
What
are the components of a meditative state then if I want to, say, become more resilient? What are the necessary components for meditation?
Well, one of the kinds of meditation – first of all, there are many kinds of meditation. One of the kinds of meditation that I described that I think could be helpful for – to promote more resilience is mindfulness meditation. Mindfulness can be defined simply as paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. And that takes training. But we can learn to pay attention in that way. And the non-judgmental piece is particularly important because one of the things that ensnares us and that leads to a persistence of negative emotion is when we judge our thoughts, when we judge situations. But if you can learn to pay attention, just say, oh, there's, you know, another thought of this kind that's arising without judging it, allowing it to arise. And one of the things that people notice and that scientific research has confirmed is that after some period of time, it's like putting a bull in a large open space. Eventually, it will tire and the thoughts begin to subside. And so that is one strategy which research has actually demonstrated to promote a more resilient kind of emotional style.
You must have been called a hippie professor and called various things along the way. What kinds of responses have you gotten that have somewhat amused you?
Well, one of the interesting comments that I received occurred in 2005. I was instrumental in getting the Dalai Lama invited to address the Society for Neuroscience, which is the most prestigious professional organization of neuroscientists. This was in Washington, D.C. And there was a petition that was sent around protesting his appearance at the Society for Neuroscience because some scientists objected to a religious leader addressing a scientific organization. Of course, there were also political overtones since the first 400 signatories were Chinese or Chinese Americans. But putting that aside, there were also some American scientists who signed that petition. And one of the comments – there was an article in the New York Times about this, and one of the comments that was made is that Davidson can't possibly be objective in his research on this topic because he's actually admitted in public that he meditates.
How terrible.
And, you know,
I
love that criticism. Right. It would be like telling a scientist who studies cognition that they can't think from now on because that may bias. Or, you know, closer to this, maybe a cardiologist who studies the effects of physical exercise on the heart that they can't engage in any physical exercise because it would bias their approach to this. So, you know, those have been some interesting challenges that I've actually enjoyed taking on. I must say, though, that for the most part, you know, we've tried to do this work at the highest levels of science and really maintain impeccability and publish in the best scientific journals. And also use the tools and concepts from modern science. And when we do it in that way, I found that most reasonable scientists are actually willing to listen. I never expected that change would occur as rapidly as it is occurring. But for me to be able to actually get NIH funds, the National Institute of Health, which is the premier funding organization for biomedical research in this country, actually in the world, to have them fund research on this topic was not something I really dreamt would occur in my lifetime. And it is occurring. It's a wonderful opportunity, I think.
It's been a wonderful opportunity talking to you, Richard Davidson. Fascinating stuff, and obviously we have just, as they say, scratched the surface. Thanks for giving us some idea about the emotional life of your brain and ours.
Thank you, Norman and Emily. It was wonderful to be here.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.